You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Hey guys, welcome to a bonus episode. This is a passion project that Daniel came up with. Not unlike last podcast on the left, among others. This is a story where he's going to try to tell a tale, and John and I are going to challenge his integrity. I hope you enjoy, and I'll let Daniel take it from here. If you like this kind of stuff, please let us know, because we'll be throwing it up in various places, and we're looking for potential future projects. So get back. Thanks.
The first episode of Disremembered, the stories behind your childhood. My name is Daniel, and on mic we've got...
I'm John.
And I'm Nick, host of Myopia Defend Your Childhood and riffer on Cineprov.
Nick's been kind enough to let me do the hosting duties for this one, and we're doing something a little different. Everybody remembers certain pieces of work from their childhood. It could be a movie, it could be a book, it could be anything. But how did that stuff happen, and how was it made?
How did this get made, in fact?
Essentially, yes, but I won't just be yelling at June for hating robots on this show. Throughout the seasons, we're going to go behind the scenes into a company's history, the development of a popular movie, or the development of a popular book series. And for the first season, we're going to talk about the Disney Renaissance.
Ooh, so Pixar.
Not exactly. But they'll get mentioned, but it's more about the egos behind
it. Land Before
Time. Yeah.
Yes, it's more about the egos behind it, because at the very top of Disney in the 80s and 90s, there was one guy in charge, Michael Eisner, who was, by all accounts, a complete ass.
I thought it was just because they fired Tim Burton because he was kind of a... He looks like a pedophile. And he was one of their head animators. And so they're just like, you know, we're better off without him.
Have you seen pictures of him back in the day? He doesn't look so much like a pedophile as a Tiny Tim cosplayer.
I just imagine, like, one time the animation... Like, they were giving a tour of the animation studios and Tim Burton kind of looked up and goes... I have an idea about a man with razors for fingertips. And they're like, you know, we're not on the...
We'll go the other way on
that. Why don't you go and have a seat over there?
And yet they're hiring him to remake their movies now.
Yeah, go have a seat with Roy Disney.
Dumbo.
And
he's remaking Dumbo.
Well, and you already did two Alice in Wonderland movies.
Oh, God.
Well, we're talking about good movies.
We are obviously not in the Disney Renaissance now.
Yeah. No. Well, the funniest thing about the Disney Renaissance is by the time it ended, sometime in the early 2000s, they were more or less at the same point they started. Their movies were bombing. Their CEO was beleaguered, is going to be the word I'm going to use for reasons. And they were almost bought out by another company. And this, back in the day, we'll get into that, but back in the early 2000s, it was Comcast of all people.
Wow. I was going to say, who's big enough to buy out Disney?
Comcast would, God, that's we're that close because they own Universal now.
Mm-hmm. And so, NBC and...
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so...
Merging of the evil empires.
Man, either way, they would have controlled a third of the networks on TV. Mm-hmm. Oh, that sucks. Mm-hmm. Jesus Christ.
Before we delve into the story, I'd first like to shout out to a couple of people. First, Ken Polson, who runs kpolson.com. He's got a timeline of literally everything that Disney ever did, ever. If you want to know what Disney was having for lunch in 1952, Mr. Polson's got you covered. I also would like to give a shout out to a woman named, I believe, Pamela Howell, who wrote something for the Western Kentucky University about the attempted buyout in the 80s, so thank you. It's very hard to get some information because the way image-conscious Disney likes to do it is basically, we've always been awesome, we've always done the right thing, don't question us. But obviously that's not true.
That's why we have the Oliver and Company ride at Universal Epcot, Disney Epcot.
Well,
they're remaking Epcot now, which is something we, I guess, will get a little bit into because, well, we're talking about the 90s, right? And the 90s now have completely pervaded pretty much all the parks, mm-hmm. right? There's the Lion King and Animal Kingdom. There's Little Mermaid pretty much throughout, right? Mm-hmm. And then there's that weird 80s period where they don't mention anything that happened. Because Magic Kingdom is a lot of nostalgia. It's the old stuff. There's a Snow White ride that they opened this year.
Mm-hmm. I'm surprised there isn't a Tron ride. Is there a Tron ride?
Wasn't there?
There was. Was it at Epcot?
think it was Epcot.
Yeah. So, because you guys don't know this kind of crap, because...
There was also a Star Wars ride back in the day.
Yeah. And,
well,
of course...
Well, now it's weird.
Well, now it's completely different.
You guys don't know this because I don't talk about it, but I used to sell video games for... some side money, and I ended up with a bunch of Tron video games for the Atari 2600.
Ah.
You used to have to use your imagination for everything. Mm-hmm. It used to be real crap.
A pixel moving across a field. It's so realistic.
Yeah. Tron Deadly Disc sounds interesting, but it's not.
Well, it was the arcade game of Tron that was the only thing that made money. Tron itself bombed, but we will get into that.
Jeff Bridges, please.
All right. The Renaissance actually starts in 1966 when Walt died. Now, there's a lot of rumors about that he was cryogenically frozen and that he feeds on Cuban children to this day until Fidel Castro shot him. None of that's true. He was cremated and he's buried. But one of the other big rumors that was going around was that Disney had actually left behind a series of film instructions to his board of directors about, okay, it's 1973. Here's what you said you'd be working on. Are you working on that? Essentially running the company from beyond the grave. That is also not true at all, unfortunately.
Wait, then why do we still have the Carousel of Progress? That thing is bullshit. That's the only thing I could figure. Also, cryogenic freezing is terrifying.
Yes.
There's an episode of This American Life called Mistakes Were Made about this guy who just like was in charge of a cryogenic freezing facility. Holy shit. They leaked and started rotting. It was just awful. No, it's never. I'd rather die.
The thing about it is, though, at the time of his death, Disney didn't even run the company. He did not have the controlling stock and left the day-to-day running of the business to his brother, Roy. He was basically the Stan Lee of Disney. He was a good mascot who loved doing the public events, but he had nothing to do with anything in the company at the time of his death. Well, he was in charge of their creative items. So all the movies were him, and he also had some oversight onto the rights, the theme parks. But
so he was
he
more
wasn't
like a creative director rather than a CEO.
Right, exactly. Which meant that when he died, though, there was still that big hole because people looked up to him, and they would ask creatively what Walt would have done. He made no preparations for how the company would be run after his death.
We need to think about this then in terms of Apple, mm-hmm. right? Because this is very
Steve
much
Jobs.
Steve Jobs,
yeah.
right? Like, and what's his name? Tim Cook, who's, I guess, okay. But he even started by coming out in a black turtleneck, if I recall correctly, just so you feel that little Steve Job kind of like contact high. But yeah, it's an interesting kind of thing because I do imagine not only him being kind of an asshole, but like you do have, even despite what you were talking about, like being false.
Right.
What he did do was just as crazy. He made a town in Central Florida called Celebration where they didn't allow black people. I mean, because he's Disney, he can do what he wants. But like he was buying around things out of a helicopter so that he could make the Magic Kingdom and the other 30 parks in that area. Like he made a town in Buena Vista, California, so that he could not technically be in L.A. or Anaheim.
Yes.
He's just, we'll get to the Mighty Ducks for Christ's sake, but... But like when you have that much power, he's almost the intellectual creative mind of America. I can't imagine what it was like to be a director not associated with Disney, which is, I guess, where we get to the 1970s and the U.S. Southern California, rather USC film schools, because they're just like, we can't do it this way anymore. This is the anti-studio system all of a sudden.
Yes, because the
foreshadowing.
Studios, yes. At the time of his death, Disney was involved in two projects. That was Epcot and his final film that he was overseeing, The Jungle Book. Which, side note, I never got that movie.
The Jungle Book?
Really?
Yeah.
It was good.
It was fine.
For what it was. It wasn't a masterpiece in the same way that a lot of his movies were, but it's still a classic.
I will say, not only do I agree with John, it has a lot of the old themes, which is this kind of vaguely... when I teach it in class, I call it American imperialist culture. Mm-hmm. We take something that's European or whatever, and we all put it under one Disney roof. You know, it doesn't matter if it's Mulan from Japan or English or German or Irish stories. They're all made more homogenistic in America. And this is a perfect example of an English story about an Indian character raised by animals to become human again. Because, I mean, this is by the guy who wrote The White Man's Burden, for God's sake.
Yes,
but,
I was about to say.
Yeah.
Which, if I recall correctly, the book is a lot more about white man's burden and how man needed to tame the jungle. Or
well, yeah, if I remember right, the movie ends with Mowgli going off to
he's going to go get
the town,
some tail.
But then he wants to come back because he doesn't want to leave.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. But I want to say the book ends with him going off and that's it, because that's his proper place, not the jungle.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and you're talking about the last movie that he oversaw to completion before he died.
Mm-hmm.
There's a movie that came out after he died that was his baby that he wouldn't let die. Do you know this story?
No, I don't.
It's called The Happiest Millionaire. It is a 3-hour long musical about a guy who was a millionaire who went overseas to Asia, learned a bunch of martial arts, and then was hired by the Marines to teach hand-to-hand combat to the Marines. They don't focus on any of that. Instead, they focus on his son going off to marry a woman. And it's a musical. And Disney, they like essentially greenlit the project before he died.
Mm-hmm.
So they had to finish it after he died. You can't cancel Disney's last movie.
It seems like you can.
Seems like you should have.
Yeah. So they actually made this thing?
Yeah, you can find it. It's very bad. Oh. It's very long.
Look at it this way. There's not exactly a revival right now of people to remake The Happiest Millionaire.
He did have a pit full of crocodiles in his house.
Oh, well, I've got one of those. So Roy, his brother, stayed on as CEO of the company.
I don't know why that tickles me so much, but when you're thinking of epic names in American history, for some reason we have a lot of Toms and Jameses, but there's not a lot of Roy!
Roy!
Well, there's going to be several Roy Disneys in this store. There's his brother and his nephew.
It just sounds like a rip-off Mario Brothers game where you have to play as Roy.
Yeah, no one wants to play as Roy.
It sounds like the joke name for Sim Park or something.
Rick and Morty, the Roy game, I'm just saying.
That's what I'm saying. Like,
a life well lived. So, Roy was currently running the company even though he was 8 years older than his brother Walt. In other words, he was well past retirement. But he still kept going. In 1967, Walt Disney World broke ground. That was overseen by Roy. Unfortunately, the films were suffering. We talked about The Happiest Millionaire, and among the other things released in 1967 included The Shaggy Dog.
Oh, yeah. I love that movie.
Didn't they remake it with Tim Allen?
Yeah, that's a shame.
Here's another remake, The Absent-Minded Professor, which was remade as Flubber.
That was Jerry Lewis, wasn't it?
No.
You're thinking of Dr. Doolittle. No, you're right.
No, it was Jerry Lewis.
Jerry Lewis.
No, you're thinking of The Nutty Professor.
Oh, you're right.
Who did The Absent-Minded Professor?
Well, that was a Disney. I don't remember who was in the original one.
That's what the Googles are for.
Yeah.
Indeed.
If I could spell absent-minded, that'd be great. It's not going to happen, but it'll tell me. Dear dipshit, this is how you spell absent-minded professor. Ooh, 1961. There you go. Ignore me.
Okay.
Oh, it was Fred McMurray. Huh. Wow. Hey. Go ahead. Right.
Also released was The Gnome-mobile. Is that a big
movie? Yeah. So, growing up, I used to watch the Disney Channel, and I'm sure most of us did, but back in the
I guess the 90s,
and I guess I'm showing my age, but the late 80s, the Disney Channel was very different from what it is today, and they showed a lot of these old movies and shorts. They didn't have commercials, so it would be like a film like The Absent-Minded Professor for 2 hours, and then you'd have a Mickey Mouse 15-minute short, and then you'd have, you know, the Gnome-mobile, and they would actually have ABC or Universal, whatever, movies in the evening. Like, I remember seeing Ghostbusters on Disney Channel.
I seem to recall hearing that back in the day, that was the only way you could see anything from Song of the South, because they cut out the cartoon.
That's how I saw
segments.
Song of the South.
Okay,
yeah. Zippity-doo-dah and all that.
Yeah, and the Disney sing-along songs.
Yeah.
They survived in the 80s effectively on nostalgia, because it's funny, because I know you're going to get to it, but a lot of the formula didn't change. Let's have a pop musician write a soundtrack and put together a movie. It just, it was clearly not, like, they're even classics, because I like Oliver and Company as an example, because it's...
I only just realized it was based off Charles Dickens.
Right.
It's like, it never twigged on me that it was...
making a musical based off of Oliver Twist?
Yeah.
And that was,
it never...
That's
twigged.
Not something that happened.
It's not until I realized that the owner or whatever was named Fagin. I'm like,
that was even the tagline, I think. The classic story of Oliver with a twist.
Even though they completely changed the story around.
Well, that's why I didn't recognize it.
Yeah.
That was the Billy Joel one, I think.
And Bette Midler, if I recall, was in that as well.
And probably Zachary Taylor Thomas, because he was in everything.
Well, this was a little early for...
Jonathan Taylor Thomas.
You're right.
Hmm.
Side note, I found this out when I was looking this up. The Gnomobile is based on a book by Upton Sinclair.
Noted communist governor.
And when it comes to children's movies, totally makes sense.
I love the scene where the Gnomobile falls into a meat grinder.
But then they also did Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, which...
Chitty Bang Bang.
Yes.
Written by Roald Dahl. Was the script written by Roald Dahl? It was like the switcheroo.
He contributed to it. Yeah. Like, he created the Child Catcher, but he didn't write the script. Yeah. It wasn't only him.
Yeah. Ian Fleming was... Oh, my God. Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
So Roy didn't actually last long. He retired in 1968 and died in 1971. Hmm. Don Tatum takes his place.
When did he do the, was it The Shadow? No, there was some other thing that he did. It was like an action, super violent thing. They made a movie of it maybe 10 years ago with Samuel L. Jackson.
Shaft. Oh.
Was it Samuel L. Jackson? It was like a Nazi or something?
Oh my God, I have no idea what you're talking about. The Phantom. Oh, The Phantom.
That was Alec Baldwin.
Yeah, no, that was The Shadow.
That was The Shadow.
With Alec Baldwin.
The Phantom was something different.
That was Billy Zane.
Yeah, that was a Roy Disney comic book, wasn't it?
Are you thinking Will Eisner?
Maybe I am thinking Will Eisner.
No, I think that was a little early. I think Roy was just more of a businessman rather than the creative side. Now, talking about the films, though, they were still suffering. The Aristocats.
Oh, shit jokes.
Which was actually the first animated movie completed after Disney's death. Hmm. Also in this time period, they released Bedknobs and Broomsticks, which we've all seen as part of Myopia.
Yeah.
That movie was so long, I sobered up in the middle of it.
That was a mistake. Although
they must have had two different versions.
You know, in retrospect, I do wonder who watched The Manchurian Candidate, saw the main villain, said she's perfect to headline our children's movie.
That's right. That's the order, too. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And again... This is one of those times where I'm going to say the actors actually did nothing wrong. So bad in bad movies when we watch them, it's the actors can tell it's bad, but like they're all acting their asses off. This movie,
and they're top-notch actors too for the time.
They are, and it's just the movie goes nowhere. It's 100% an editing issue, and that's why when we did that episode, which came out, God, maybe 6, 7, 8 months ago, the problem we had with it was. We had all seen a shorter version, we thought. Mm-hmm. Who knows? Maybe we just blanked out large parts of it, but man.
Yeah, that was... Well, originally, it was a lot longer, but they cut some scenes from it, and I don't think some of that deleted footage... I think it's just gone forever. They tried to
restore
it. Yeah.
Having seen the 2.5-hour version of that.
The Criterion version, which is like a serial. It's like 12 episodes.
Well, there is something positive about Bedknobs and Broomsticks. It was a huge bomb at the box office. It cost $20 million to make and only grossed $17 million.
Wait, in like $1970?
Yeah.
Jesus Christ, wow. $20 million is a lot.
Well, it had really good special effects. Even for now, they're decent special effects.
Well, I mean, it reminds me of something like Who Framed Roger Rabbit in the interaction with cartoons, but it's more seamless.
Well, Mary Poppins did that first, though. And I don't know. They were trying to, I think, remake Mary Poppins, basically, with Nazis.
Absolutely, yeah.
But, I mean, to wit, it's what you do when your studio's in trouble, right? It's not even a...
You go back to the classics.
To a formula that works... However, like, I mean, you mentioned Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. That song they play, I think, 3 times. This one had an original score, at least. What is it? Portobello Road?
Portobello Road.
Yeah. It's a classic. It's a classy song.
I think I've been on Portobello Road at some point.
Yeah, it's fine. It's kind of mushroom.
One other thing about the old Roy. He had a son also named Roy. This is Roy E. Disney, Disney's nephew, who still remained a very influential figure in the company after his father's death. He was a shareholder at the time of his death. He passed away in 2009. He had about still 1% of the company, and he still remained a longtime senior executive throughout this. So in terms of the Disney family, he was the go-to guy, and he's going to become very important in the Disney Renaissance and in Michael Eisner's rise and fall. But in the meantime, we are still on the bad days. Their next animated film after the Aristocats, I cannot just say that correctly, I'm sorry, was Robin Hood, another throwback, which did well at the box office, but was a critical bomb, which is very unusual for Disney. It currently has a 52% rating on Rotten Tomatoes.
Really?
Yes.
I wouldn't have thought it was that low.
Well, and it's responsible for creating an entire generation of furries, so there's something there.
Yeah. Ooh.
Sexy foxes.
But if I remember right, there was also, it cribbed a lot from prior movies.
Yes, it did.
So
it was done on the cheap. They were reusing animation to cut down on costs. They did that a lot at the time.
Well, and it's, I mean, we also did an episode on this, it's funny enough. But as I recall, you particularly didn't like it for the soundtrack. The knockoff folk music bothered you.
I just don't recall that. Well, I'm not a big fan of folk music, but I just don't think that the songs really help the story move along.
Well, I mean, but whatever, the Chicken Boo narrator there.
Oodle-ally.
Oodle-ally, oodle-ally, golly, what a day.
Well, that Microsoft commercial that used that song was actually pretty decent. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't mind it. It was one of the ones that I watched a million billion times growing up, but it's funny that you bring up that it was such a commercial failure, because not only do I not think of it in like the terms of success or failure, Disney is really good at hiding the movies that it's embarrassed about.
Yes.
And that's something that movie is actually kind of hard to find. Not impossible. It's not like the Black Cauldron, which you can literally not find.
They did not release that for many years.
You know, and it's not, frankly, the bigger thing about Song of the South is not that it's super racist, because, I mean, Joel Chandler Harris, you can debate the racism of it, but it's the stories he was told by essentially the servant that raised him. But the reason it's not released is that it's just a bad movie. You know, like, there's a lot of racism in Gone with the Wind, but, I mean, for example, Rhett is a Klansman.
Yes.
Yeah. But then it's also a movie about the South in the Civil War, so what would you expect? But the Uncle Remus stories of Song of the South, I vaguely remember that when they came out, like originally, they were considered progressive because it had a black protagonist, a black narrator. Mm-hmm. It was about black stories for black people.
The actor in Song of the South, I think, was the first adult actual actor rather than a cartoon that Disney used and kept under contract, and I think he won a special Oscar for that movie as well. So,
well, and
kind of progress.
Well, and we talk about how Mary Poppins is cribbing. He's dancing through cartoons and singing to cartoon characters in the 40s, for God's sake. Mm-hmm. That's it. Mm-hmm. And it's, I mean, now again, the movie's not particularly great, but the Disney sing along songs had zippity doo dah, and I do remember a lot of the shorts. Yeah. So,
and for a movie that I guess you could call technologically advanced for the 40s, to have a black protagonist
is
probably in itself
raising white kids.
Yeah. Which is, I'm sure we've covered it in Myopia, it's a trope in and of itself. The wise old black man raising the white kids or acting as a mentor or whatever.
So where were we?
No, please.
But I digress.
We're going from the 40s back to the 70s. Which also in the 70s with their films is that a lot of the classic animators who'd made the classic Disney films were retiring. Some of the people had been there since 1927, so they were quitting, including Milt Kahl is the person I've got in my notes who retired in 1976. It demonstrated that, again, this was a time of change for the company, but they weren't really responding to it. Mostly what they would do is keep re-releasing their older films into theaters. Now, granted, this was before videos existed, and they were on top of that when that became big.
Yeah, I vaguely remember that movies became such a big thing, especially in the South, because there was no air conditioning more often than not, except in the movie theater. And for 25 cents or whatever, you could spend all day in the theater just chowing down on popcorn and watching movie after movie after movie, which would be released repeatedly over a year, because no one would want just a 2-week period, and then that's the only time you could see it.
Well, and
that was the only entertainment they had.
In the modern era, we're getting to the era where blockbusters are essentially going to destroy themselves, because I think there's something like 70 blockbusters coming out in 2018. But I had a question for the table.
Yes.
Was there ever a movie you saw during the summer growing up distinctly so that you could go into the air conditioning? Do you have an air conditioning movie?
I don't know. I grew up in the north, so.
No, I was just thinking about it because, like, there were those summer days where I was just like, I want to do something out of the house.
Well, I was a latchkey kid growing up, and so my brother and I would frequently walk because both my parents were at work. We'd walk down to the theater, and we would just see whatever.
Oh, yeah, no. I mean, that's what I'm thinking. Like, I remember the Jonathan Taylor Thomas movie, Tom and Huck.
Ah, yes.
Which is one that I think had even come out a few years before. But like you said, the local movie theater would do these kind of like, you know, $5 to see a thing and you'd get like a little popcorn, right? And so I saw a bunch of movies during the summer that were just not even good or bad. They were just indifferent. And generally, that's kind of what Disney was doing. Like even during the Eisnerissance, you'd have the big kind of cornerstone movies. But in between, there was just a constant flow of Tim Allen and, you know, precocious kid movies.
They tried so hard to make Tim Allen a star.
Well, it was after he had done so much cocaine that he had gone to prison for a bit.
Yes,
and so they needed him to do anything. And they bought those kind of people up. They also bought Eddie Murphy up after he had gone to prison for buying that prostitute who turned out to be a man.
Oh, he went to prison for that?
Well, he was arrested. Oh. And that kind of destroys your career for
a bit.
So
you're saying they were getting cheap actors.
That had a name.
Yeah.
I mean, because it was after that that he did the Dr. Doolittle and the Daddy Daycare and that kind of stuff as well. So you have this kind of like, well, Disney will erase that record.
Well, it's the thing, though. I mean, Eddie Murphy used to be this very vulgar comedian who was squarely aimed at adult. Same with Tim Allen, yeah. And same with Bob Saget.
Bob Saget, yeah.
All of them eventually go into family films because that's where the money is. Mm-hmm.
Well, and Disney is glad to help gloss you over your past because kids don't know your background. And if you're charming, the dad's like, I remember when Emilio Estevez had a career. Why don't we see Mighty Ducks?
How did that, does that explain when they kept giving work to the guy that directed Jeepers Creepers, even though he's a convicted sex offender?
Well, you know.
Ask Roman Polanski.
That's Roman Polanski. That's funny.
Everyone's got their allies.
One thing that was successful at the time, though, were the parks. Walt Disney World had 10 million visitors the first year that it opened. Wow. However, even that wasn't consistent. It actually had 800,000 fewer visitors in 1974 compared to 1973. That was really, for a while, what was keeping the company afloat. They didn't care as much about the movies. And that especially...
And that would have been just on nostalgia, too, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
On the early movies.
Well, and to your point, the original Walt Disney Land was made essentially because he was willing to sell part of the company to ABC. And that's why we have the Wide World of Disney. Mm-hmm. And that's why we're able to get all these things. And it became an icon. So when they were like, we'll build one on the East Coast, it's not only nostalgia, but it's also kind of like, let's experience what the rest of the country has been able to experience. And so, yeah, 10 million people, thumbs up. But also, we're not adding anything to these parks.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Disneyland and Disney World are essentially clones of each other. Mm-hmm. Disney World just has more properties, so they're less likely to evolve out a ride. So we have a lot more old rides in Florida than they do in California because they just have no room for them anymore.
Well, I'm just glad they got rid of the Country Bears Jamboree. Damn bears.
You can see them at Chuck E. Cheese.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
That's dead eyes.
It's like Slash.
I'm still glad they kept the... The Song of the South ride, though.
Oh, yeah, Splash Mountain.
Splash Mountain, that's one of my favorites.
Yeah.
That became a problem, though, with the guy who replaced Don Tatum, the CEO. A guy named Card Walker, who started out as a mail clerk.
Card Walker?
E. Cardon Walker.
Card, okay.
Card E. Cardon Walker. Blue? It sounds like a fake French name, for Christ's sake.
That was his name.
He was in the mailroom, huh?
He started out in the mailroom in 1938, I believe. And he became the CEO in 1976 after Don Tatum quit.
Jesus Christ.
That's a success
story. That's a story, man.
Walker was highly unpopular with the staff, who they considered him a tyrant.
Oh, I'll take that back.
He was very protective of Disney's family image, which is why the films weren't taking any new chances. Mm. He also wouldn't advertise theme parks. Pretty much if they wanted to increase viewership at all, he'd ask one of the major networks at the time, ABC, NBC, whoever, to say, hey, do you mind filming an hour-long special in our park? And that would be it. It got so bad that Roy E. Disney, back to the Roys, quit as VP of Productions in 1977. He said it was because Disney focused too much on the theme parks and not enough on the films. He still remained on the board of directors because he was the largest stockholder. Also in 1977, the Mickey Mouse Club was relaunched. I just wanted to throw that out there.
It was relaunched?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. I didn't know it went away.
Yeah.
Well, it goes in cycles. It was there around in the 50s with Annette.
Cool, oh, yeah. Okay.
You know, the people that all our dads liked.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially Annette. And then in the 70s, it came back. And then in the 90s, you know, that was Britney Spears and Christina Aguilera.
I remember the 90s.
And Justin Timberlake?
I believe so, yes.
Justin Timberlake, yeah.
Disney was also ranking up more film flops after Roy quit as the VP of productions. By 1979, profits in their film production studio were the lowest they'd been in a decade. And their film's box office share was the lowest of the seven major studios.
So what kind of stuff were they putting out?
The sort of stuff that we've been talking about, like Bedknobs and Broomsticks, and dumb live-action films. And
Robin Hood?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay.
Yes, and Robin Hood.
So things that now we would consider good, not necessarily classics, like Snow White.
They weren't even really considered good at the time. Mm-hmm. It's stuff like, if you remember Watcher in the Woods, which was a huge bomb at the time. That's the sort of things they were putting out, which I seem to recall... My middle school teacher at one point decided, I don't feel like teaching today. And that was how she filled the time, was by showing us that movie.
So this is the type of stuff that now we would call Disney made-for-TV movies.
Yes.
Well, I mean, they had... I was just looking
at Disney Channel original movies, those type of things. Like Xenon, Girl of the 20th Century, or whatever.
Well, how do you know those?
I had really younger brothers. And so they watched Disney while I was in high school.
I see.
Well, and here's some examples of things that are, like you said, movies that we've heard of, but not ones we've seen recently. For example, one I kind of like, Escape to Witch Mountain is one of them.
Mm-hmm. They also remade that.
With The Rock, I think. But there's also the sequel, Return from Witch Mountain. There's Pete's Dragon, which no one should see. I know you think it's a classic. Rewatch it.
No, it's not.
It's no good.
It is not.
The only one on the list that I can see, there's two that I remember liking, which is The Many Adventures of Winnie the Pooh.
Yeah.
And The Rescuers. Yes. But the rest of them are like Harvey the Lug Pug. Harvey the Lug Pug.
Oh, yes. Herbie was coming out.
No.
Oy.
Thank you, John. That
sums it up nicely.
I will say this about Pete's dragon. The dragon talks exactly like the gorilla from Glove and Boots.
The Apple Dumpling Gang Rides Again came out in 1979.
Yes.
I've seen all these at one point or another.
I'm sure you have. I have too, I think.
I'm pretty sure I've seen them exactly once.
Gus. Shaggy D.A.
Oh, boy.
Freaky Friday.
The original's not that good.
No, I mean, it's not, but there you go. I could keep listing them. Herbie Goes to Monte Carlo.
Oh, that's a classic there.
Yeah.
They remade those with Lindsay Lohan, right?
Well, the guys behind The State and Reno 911 helped write that movie.
Oh, Tom Lennon. And
yeah, Tom Lennon, Robert Ben Garrett.
Yeah.
Black Hole?
Yes.
Yeah.
Wow.
Which is a...
That was, if I remember right, their attempt at serious adult-themed sci-fi.
Yes.
And mixed reviews. Will we get into that?
Well, we're going to get into one thing. I talked about Tron earlier, which was released in 1982. It was such a bomb that Disney stock fell 2.5% the day that it opened.
Wow. Wow.
Excuse me, 2.5 points, not percent.
Okay.
But still.
But still.
That actually might be more than 2.5%. I don't know what their stock was at.
Wow.
God damn. That's amazing.
Another big problem Disney was facing at the time was that a lot of their animators were leaving and forming their own companies and actually outperforming Disney movies. This is Don Bluth.
Yeah, okay.
In 1979, specifically September 1979, Bluth left the company, and by the next month, 11 more people had joined him to form their own company. At first, Bluth's first film, which was The Secret of Nim, it bombed too, and actually they had to declare bankruptcy, but... An American Tale became the highest non-Disney grossing animated film.
Wow.
Excuse me, the highest grossing non-Disney animated film.
I followed you, kind of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They're both solid movies.
And we're talking about the early 80s now.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, they're competing against some crap movies, though. I mean, Fox and the Hound is probably the biggest downer ever.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right up there with Bambi. The downer part of Bambi's in the first act. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Great Mouse Detective, which I kind of like.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Great Mouse Detective came later. It came after Michael Eisner was the CEO.
Okay, so okay. We won't get there yet.
Not yet.
What was the first one he came under? Was that Black Cauldron, or is that the last one he did?
Well, they started work on Black Cauldron in 1980 and didn't finish it for a few years. And actually, he and Jeffrey Katzenberg, who we'll get to in later episodes.
Katzenberg is like, he's a huge deal.
Oh, yeah.
Isn't he the K in SKG?
Is he? By the way, I didn't know that they made Popeye, but I think Popeye was Paramount, and they own Paramount at this point, right?
Who? Katzenberg and Eisner?
No, Disney.
No, they didn't.
Oh, really? Okay.
Okay.
So Popeye is something that I thought was a Disney movie.
No.
It wouldn't surprise me.
Robin Williams singing a musical. It's a musical, and it's Altman, right? It's a Robert Altman. I will gladly pay you Tuesday. I'm sorry, I'm done. That just seems like a Disney bullshit musical.
Kind of sort. I've only seen maybe 30 seconds of that, and I'm like, I'm done.
Robin Williams has a blonde, like this horrible orange blonde hair. It's amazing. Anyway, you can go.
All right. Well, you mentioned the Black Cauldron. They started production on that in 1980, and jumping a little bit ahead, that was almost a film that earned an R rating.
Really?
Because
really?
It had a lot of graphically violent scenes. We'll get into that later, but that is another big problem that would come for Disney.
So are we seeing that they're trying to hit a more adult audience because they're getting more dark, more violent?
Their problem was that they weren't taking any chances with their films at all.
That seems to be taking a chance to have an excessively violent children's film.
That wouldn't come, though, until later, unfortunately. At the time, it was still, remember, it's this Card Walker dude who was in charge. And he did not want...
So having Darth Vader at the top of the pyramid kind of trickles down.
It's the problem.
Now, their parks were still doing well, and there was still a lot of demand for their brand. In 1980, Disney started releasing the first video cassettes, including stuff like Nick was mentioning, the Herbie movies and all of that stuff, but also their older classic animated films.
The Vault. This is when that Vault bullshit starts.
Well, they're still following the model, basically, that they would in the past, where instead of re-releasing it into theaters, they re-release it on home video, which kind of pisses me off because at this point, it's just encouraging piracy.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's the thing. I don't really have a moral code for this, but I always... Like, I don't, for the example, the Nintendo Classic. Everyone wanted a Nintendo Classic. I wanted a Nintendo Classic, and I don't really care that much. But if you make things impossible to get, people are just going to pirate them. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, you know, if they were easy to get, I'd have more of a problem with people trying to make their own Raspberry Pi versions. But if you literally can't find it, who cares? Like, it's your fault.
And unfortunately, the Nintendo is a physical thing that you can't easily recreate, except with a Raspberry Pi or something like that, an emulator. A Disney movie, you just copy it onto Dropbox or you copy it onto a file sharing thing, and it's out there.
Yeah, and it's
and
not
by
hard.
You artificially making it a short market, you're just hurting yourself because people will find some other way to do it.
Yeah, man.
Preach.
Preach.
Not that anyone here are pirates. We all have legal entertainment.
Legal.
He did not just throw up quotes.
Well, the movies we do for Myopia, unless they're completely out of print, we kind of have to because we talk over everything, so we need the subtitles.
Yes. Still in the early 80s, the one thing keeping them going was the theme parks until attendance started declining because the overall economy was very bad, especially under the first... Yeah. Well, you know, mommy. So they were in trouble at that point. Finally, in 1983, Card Walker quit. He was replaced by a guy named Ron W. Miller. Miller was a star football player at SoCal. I refuse to call it USC because USC is in South Carolina, not California.
Tell that to the law.
Did they have universities?
It was a court case, wasn't it?
It was.
Yeah. Well, you know what? They're wrong.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
Go
yeah.
Cox. He was a star football player at USC who eventually was introduced and married to one of Walt's daughters, Diane. So that was his big break in the company. He was president of productions for a while and actually got production credit, producer credit, on a lot of things, including Pete's Dragon. Hmm. So in 1983, he becomes the CEO. Uh-huh. At the time, there was already rumblings of a takeover attempt. First was in 1982 by Atlanta's very own Coca-Cola. They tried to buy Disney.
Really?
In 1982.
A hostile takeover by Coca-Cola.
It didn't work.
No shit.
The panda tried to take over the mouse.
That's funny.
Well, the polar bear, you mean.
Sorry, polar bear, yeah.
The panda comes later when the Japanese or the Chinese try in there.
But we're going to focus on the one in 1984 that nearly destroyed the company. Huh. A gentleman by the name of Saul Steinberg wanted to buy the company outright and sell it piecemeal to enormous profit. In other words, he would buy the company and then sell the parks, sell the production studios, sell the rights to everything. That was just his MO.
Something a hedge fund would do today.
Yeah. Exactly. And he was almost able to do it and made his intentions known very early on. At the time, Steinberg announced he wanted 25% of the company and said he was going to get it. Mm-hmm. He was the sort of guy who could recognize undervalued stock and he would then buy it and get rid of management. In this case, he wanted to liquidate Disney's assets via something called value stripping, okay. Which, like I just said.
Yeah.
Roy at the time, who was still on the board of directors, good old Roy, mm-hmm. He's not at the carpet store, he's on the board of directors. Wubba lubba dub dub.
Yeah. Poor Roy.
He came up with a plan to save Disney. He used a bunch of so-called...
Bake sale?
Hmm? Yeah, bake sale.
Yes, bake sale. Hi, everybody. We're selling cookies on Main Street, USA today. 25 cents will help you save Disney.
That was pretty good.
Yeah,
it's
not bad. Yeah.
I'm Mickey Mouse, and my circumcision went horribly wrong.
Wow.
That went dark.
They also use something called green mail, which is the opposite of blackmail. Basically, it's public pressure to say, come on, you don't want to destroy Disney, really, do you? It was a way to foster goodwill, potentially, and stop Steinberg from doing what he was doing. Eventually, though, the only way to kill him off, Steinberg, well, kill off his takeover attempt, was to buy his existing stock for $325 million. Mm.
This is not the first time Disney tried to do something malicious to a Steinberg.
Oh, man.
I'm sorry.
Right. So the takeover attempt failed, but the fact that it had gotten so close demonstrated to Disney that they needed to change. So they fired Ron W. Miller after he was only on the job for 1 year. So in 1984, he was gone. And they replaced him with two people, Michael Eisner as the CEO and Jeffrey Katzenberg as the chairman. Mm-hmm. Their history is long and convoluted, and this really started the Disney Renaissance. And we'll talk more about Eisner and Katzenberg on our next episode.
If you guys are interested, follow us on Myopia Defend Your Childhood, which is our movie kind of review blog or a podcast where every week we put an episode up and we kind of talk about the movies you grew up with. We put your past on trial. The last Thursday of the month, we release every Thursday, Throwback Thursdays. We're doing Myopia Mornings now, where Scott Miller, Aaron Greer, and myself are talking about TV shows. And we have a wrapped up series on the James Bond movies called Mission Briefing. The main ones are still part of the feed and the website. You can find us on myopiapodcast.com or dudeletter.com. But if you're interested in just talking Bond, we're going to have some extra episodes coming out in the next few months. Until then, I've been panelist Nick Hoffman.
I'm John.
And this is your host, Daniel.
Thanks, guys.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping through Amazon.com or the T Public Store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.